Okay, first of all, Kuhn and Popper, how many of you had heard of these guys before I decided to unload them on you? Put your hands up. I want to just get a general sense. I'm not going to name names or anything.
Okay,
so we got about maybe half of you. Okay, these are probably the most important theorists of science of the second half of the 20th century, these two guys. Okay, and so the reason why I'm having you look at them and their differences is because they kind of define, especially in the way in which the understanding of science has kind of seeped down into popular culture. Because in many respects, Popper and Kuhn have actually been more influential among non-philosophers than among philosophers. Okay, that's a really important point. I mean, so Kuhn's main book, which is The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, that book is probably the best-selling book ever on the theory of science. Okay, I mean, it has sold over a million copies. It's been around now for, next year will be the 50th anniversary. And this book's been translated into maybe 25 languages. In addition to that small book that I sent you, about 10 years ago, I published a very large book of about, 400 pages with 1,000 footnotes, basically trying to figure out why it was that this book turned out to be so influential. Okay. Now, Karl Popper... Now, the thing about Kuhn's book, to say at the outset, is... And we'll talk more about the book itself. The book is a very slim volume. I don't know how many of you have actually seen the book. The book is a small book, maybe 160 pages. It was originally the final volume of the International Encyclopedia of Unified Science. Now, this was the big American project that the logical positivists did when they moved from Europe. Okay. Have you guys heard of these people, the logical positivists? Does that name a few of you know who they are? Okay. They were also, in Europe, they were known as the Vienna Circle. Okay. Wittgenstein, the great philosopher Wittgenstein, was kind of a member for a while of this group. Karl Popper was a very sort of junior hanger-on to this group. So he kind of, and his main book, The Logic of Scientific Discovery, which he published in 1935 originally in German, but was not translated into English until 1959. That book was published as part of their series when he was still in Europe. The logical positivists were basically guys, they were people who were philosophers, but originally trained in physics and mathematics, most of them. Popper was trained in psychology, as it turns out. And these were guys who basically believed that what was needed was a scientific worldview. Okay, and that there's a sense in which a scientific worldview would actually be able to figure out what kinds of claims are true, false, right, wrong, you know, at a very general level. And then you wouldn't just have to, you know, rely on authority. You could test claims, and that they came up with methods, you might say, for how to put knowledge claims into a testable form, so you could tell under what conditions would this thing be true. Kind of like an experimental method, a logical method. So logical positivists were very much devoted to that. And Popper kind of came from that tradition, but generalized it in a very big way to include politics and so forth. Popper basically thought that you could really only have an open democratic society if people's claims, even in the public sphere, were open to this kind of public testing like scientific claims are. Right, that was what he called the open society, right? The open society? Okay. So these are two quite important figures. So whereas Kuhn was trying to give an account of science by itself, you know, in other words, a theory of scientific change without any concern about larger society issues, Popper's view about science was meant to have very direct implications for how we thought about society. Because he thought of science as basically the most advanced form of social life that we have, where people are most transparent, where knowledge claims are most openly discussed and criticized. Okay? So you got these two kinds of views in the outset. There's a generation difference between the two guys. Okay? Kuhn is born in 1922. He died in 96. Popper was born in 1902. And he died in 94. Okay? And Popper, as you know, or may not know, I don't know, after World War II, because he was Jewish, he had to leave Austria. He migrated immediately to New Zealand. Okay? And then, after the war, he got brought into the London School of Economics and spent the rest of his life living here. And had like a little mansion outside of London, which is where he died. Okay? Kuhn, on the other hand, is an American, also of Jewish descent. His father, in fact, Kuhn's father, was one of the first generation of Jews allowed into Harvard, okay, in the early 20th century. Kuhn did his PhD at Harvard. His PhD was in physics. He was involved in World War II, jamming radar signals in Norwich, over here in England. But after World War II, when he was finishing up his PhD, he became very disillusioned with the way physics had turned. Because as you know, the war basically ended with the dropping of the atomic bomb, which was very much a physics thing. And I think I may have mentioned last time in the class that part of the motivation for the United States putting so much money into basic research after World War II had to do with the nature of the success of the atomic bomb project, which was run by physicists. Which is not just any old physicist, but the ones who won the Nobel Prizes for having done the fundamental research in it. And so those guys were giving the orders to the engineers to build the bomb, and it worked. Okay, and this turned out to be the first really clear case where taking scientists with a very strong kind of theoretical orientation, that they could actually do something quite practically significant if the science, the fundamental science, had been already worked out. And this became an argument for the U.S. funding basic research after World War II. Now, Kuhn became very disillusioned with all of that and didn't want to do a career in physics, even though he finished his PhD in the subject. Okay, so what Kuhn then did was, it turned out that Kuhn was kind of the protege of the president of Harvard University, this guy Conant, who's an incredibly important figure, James Bryan Conant. Conant was the chief administrator for the atomic bomb project. He's a chemist by training. He was president of Harvard University. After World War II, he became the first American ambassador to West Germany. So this guy was very, one of these, he was called in his time an action intellectual, Conant, because he was one of these academic guys who was like moving in all these different circles everywhere, okay? And Conant, one of the things he did at Harvard was to establish this thing called the General Education Program. And in particular, the thing that really stands out is the General Education in Science. And the idea would be that Harvard people, because they are Harvard people and are destined to rule the world, okay, that they needed to understand, no matter what subject they majored in, they needed to understand the stuff that runs the world. And in the post-war era, it was very clear that it would be natural science. Okay? And Conant basically wanted every English major, every history major, all of these humanists who would be kind of the normal sort of person who went to Harvard, to know something about science. This is where Kuhn gets his first job, okay? So Kuhn gets his first job teaching in this course that Conant creates. Now, what is the point of this course? Well, the point of this course is actually not to get people to study science for a living. Okay? So it is meant, in a way, as a liberal arts course, where you're studying a little bit of everything, but there's no expectation that you're going to go further and do something in depth. Okay? So then the question becomes, well, what is the spirit in which you need to know about this science?
Well, Conant said, he brings up this term, you need to be a connoisseur of science. You know, a connoisseur of art? Someone who's able to tell the good art from the bad art? Right, it's a connoisseur, right? Connoisseur of wine? Connoisseur of science.
So here's what he's imagining. He's imagining these Harvard guys are going to be powerful players. So they may be like CEOs of companies, politicians, lawyers, you know, those kinds of guys. And they are going to have to be making decisions about research funding, because research is going to become an increasingly important part of the way the world works. So what you're imagining, right, corporations will have R&D divisions. You have to choose which projects to support. Right? Government will be relying more and more on scientific expertise to get stuff done. All of this is going to happen. This is what he figures, right? It does happen, of course. So how do you judge? You're not a scientist yourself. You've got these competing experts telling you different things. How do you judge? What do you need to know? That is what the connoisseur can tell the difference. So how do you get connoisseurship? Okay. And this is where you begin to see the kind of picture that comes out in Kuhn's book beginning to get formed. Because the key thing, as far as Conant was concerned, was first of all, that there is, you might say, a kind of uniform scientific mentality. Right? So you think about it. Science has been around now for several centuries, at least since the 17th century, in terms of the way we normally think about it, you know, in terms of doing experiments and mathematics and, you know, trying to test hypotheses and this kind of the language of the scientific method. And that way of conceptualizing the production of knowledge comes pretty much from the 17th century. And of course, over the last, 300, 400 years, science has changed tremendously in terms of the way it's done, right? So, you know, Galileo, back in the early 17th century, what's he doing? He's dropping some things off of the Tower of Pisa. That's not very high tech, is it? It's a spectacle, but it's pretty low tech stuff. You could do that today if you wanted, okay? But now, of course, when we move into after World War II, we have particle accelerators, right? We have these enormous machines that spin these subatomic particles around to split them into ever finer pieces, right? It looks radically different, costs radically more money. The mathematics is completely abstruse. But Conant's point is, it's science. It's still science in exactly the same way as the stuff that Galileo was doing. Right? So the way the science is embodied, the way the science is carried out, the kinds of specific training you need to be competent in the science, all of that has changed over the last 300 or 400 years. But what has not changed is, right, the method of science, the spirit of science, something has remained the same to such an extent that by studying the simpler historical cases of science, so in other words, by studying Galileo, what he was up to, by studying what Newton was up to, studying all those early scientists, by studying what they were up to, you will get actually a very good sense of what scientists are now doing in their more complicated way. So in other words, you don't need to get the PhD in physics, but what you do need to know is something about the history of science and the underlying mentality that informed people like Galileo and Newton to do the science they did. Okay? That is the basic point that Conant got across, this is a very convenient point in a way, because you know, the students then do not need to have advanced mathematical training.
They don't need advanced technical knowledge. I mean, the kinds of equations and formulas that even Newton's working with, you know, if you don't, you know, if you sort of remove his calculus for a moment, most of it is kind of algebra, geometry type stuff that kids would have learned in high school, especially if they're Harvard students. I'm not saying ordinary students would have learned this stuff, but remember, we're talking about Harvard students. So we presume a certain level of mathematical literacy, right, going into Harvard, okay? And so the point is that if you, you know, look at the original experiments of these guys, if you look at the arguments that these guys made back in the 17th century, you could actually kind of see the mentality of what it is to do science and to be a scientist, and then you can try to recognize that in the contemporary people. That's the idea, okay? And so the way the teaching took place, and see, if you read Kuhn's book, you can see the traces of all this, is the students were given case histories. Case histories. This idea of case history is an idea that actually, some of you may know, originates in business school teaching. Law schools and business schools traditionally teach by cases. Right? In the case, you know, in the law school, you know what you want to do when you study a case is look at the judge's reasoning. Look at how so the judge may be talking about a case that took place 100 years ago, but the interesting thing isn't the particulars of the case, it's the reasoning in terms of how the judge weighed various factors. Because you, as a potential judge, someday may be in that situation. This is kind of what Conant was thinking about with regard to looking at the old scientific cases. Also, in business case histories, right, one of the things that you would be looking for is case histories of success and failure. Experiments that worked and didn't work. Right? Or you might say explanations for phenomena that worked or didn't work. Where some people claimed that certain entities existed and explained why things were the way they were, and it turns out they were wrong. So some examples. And this is an example that's very important in the Kuhn's book, and it's an example that Conant worked up. Because I think I may have mentioned Conant was a chemist by training. And so there is a lot of discussion of phlogiston versus oxygen. Okay. And this... The chemical revolution, which takes place in the 18th century, in the late 18th century, is a period when we basically come up with an understanding of the elements as we have them today. And very quickly afterwards, people start to think about it as having a certain kind of atomic structure, and that the atomic structure determines which element we're talking about. Okay? That's something that you start in the very late 18th century, and very quickly develops after that in the early 19th century. Okay. So you already have a periodic table of elements in the 1860s. Okay? But this took a very kind of substantial shift in the way people thought about chemistry. And until the late 18th century, people still thought about chemistry very much, you might say, not so differently from how the Greeks did. So like air element, fire element, water element, earth element, and things were combinations of that. It was a little more sophisticated than that, but not so much. In other words, the elements were defined very much at the level at which we would normally experience them. Right? So to the naked eye, there's a clear difference between air, fire, water, and earth. And what this revolution that took place was basically to change that completely and to say, no, there's a kind of atomic structure. And all those differences that you see are just combinations of those atoms. Right? So from a chemical standpoint, you might say, that great difference between earth, air, fire, water is superficial. It's not deep. Okay? Now, the trickiest of all of the old Greek elements to get rid of was this thing called phlogiston, which was the fire element. And so
The experiments that basically led to the discovery of oxygen came about by showing that phlogiston was impossible, that you couldn't have this kind of element. It had to be this other kind of thing. And that got people shifting. And this is where, when Kuhn talks about a paradigm shift, you've heard of that. That's one of the most famous phrases from Kuhn. Paradigm. That's what he means. Now, paradigm, are you familiar, before reading Kuhn, are you familiar with this word in English? Because this is a word that has a lot of different meanings in English, and Kuhn, in a way, uses all of them. That's what makes the word a bit confusing, but nevertheless, it's a the main definition of paradigm is a model of something. Okay. Now, the relevance of that to this point is the question is, what is your model of a chemical element? What kind of thing is a chemical element? If you're a Greek, earth, air, fire, water are the kinds of things that are chemical elements. And that gives you a sense of what they're thinking about when they think of a chemical element. But in the modern period, when you go through the paradigm shift that I'm talking about here, right, a chemical element is a combination of atoms. Right? And what makes things qualitatively different is the quantitative structure. How many atoms? How are they arranged? That is the modern chemical worldview. So your model of what an element is some combination of atoms. Right? And eventually, when people look into it more, you know, one looks into the subatomic particles. So nowadays we talk about how many neutrons, how many protons, how many electrons does an element have, and that defines what the element is. Okay? That's what an element is. An element isn't something that you determine by looking at things and saying this is qualitatively different from that. It is something that, as it were, is quantitative, that is a result of combination of the same things. Right? Combinations of the same things in different proportions gives you the different elements. Right? That's a different way of thinking about what an element is. And that's the paradigm shift, because your model of what an element is shifts. Okay? Very important. Lots of paradigm shifts like this happen in the history of science. Okay, so for example, you get a shift with regard to matter. What is matter? If you ask Aristotle, matter is the stuff of the earth. It's the stuff of the earth. Aristotle did not believe that the planets, all those things out there in the heavens, was made of matter. Not in the matter of the earth. He believed that there was a very special kind of ultra-thin matter, super, you know, kind of quintessence, the Latin scholastics called in the Middle Ages. This kind of special stardust kind of stuff, which was qualitatively different from matter on earth. And this distinction that Aristotle laid on the table, 4th century BC, made it very difficult to have a unified physical theory. Because basically Aristotle believed that the heavens were made of different stuff from the earth. And so you couldn't have a very unified theory. And Aristotle believed the stuff in the heavens was weightless, floated around. It didn't obey the kinds of principles of stuff on earth, which, you know, when you throw it up in the air, it comes down. Right? The stuff on earth had what he called gravity, which is a kind of ordinary common sense notion of gravity. Toss it up, it falls down. Not Newton's law of gravity. That's a different idea of gravity. But this kind of earthbound notion of gravity. And the stuff in the heavens, totally different. You cannot have comprehensive physics with this kind of idea. Okay? You have to shift your notion of matter so that the notion of matter that you have can cover both the heavens and the earth. Right? You need, and what that means is you've got to think about matter, once again, in a more abstract way. In a way that can capture both what goes on in the heavens and the earth. So it can't be matter as it appears to your eyes. You see, there's a pattern here. It's a very important pattern that you're seeing.
And this is the kind of thing that Conant would want to get across in the course, namely that one of the ways in which you can talk about the development of science and the move down kind of scientific mentality is when people are able to abstract away from the evidence of their perception. Because the evidence of perception, right, tells you that there are a lot of different things in the world. But are they really different? Are they different in some deep kind of way? Or is there some more profound way where they're in fact quite similar and comparable and in fact governed by the same laws? And it's when you make that move that you move into science. Okay? And so the whole point of experiment in all this, the role of experiment, and Galileo is very important in terms of breaking down this Aristotelian notion of matter, is to get you to see things in a radically different way. Because at the end of the day, you do have to see the stuff. Nowadays, of course, very few things are actually seen with the naked eye. Think about your electron microscopes, think about your radio telescopes. Most of what you in fact look at nowadays as evidence in science is mediated tremendously by technology. So most of the time, you're looking at photographs, essentially. Okay? But if you go back to the 17th century, before any of that happened, right, people are still using their eyes. Okay? And so then what the experiment does is the experiment reveals things that you would not otherwise see in the normal course of things. And in fact, Francis Bacon, who's often seen as the person who first codifies the scientific method in the 17th century, he used to talk about how you have to kind of torture nature to get it to reveal her secrets. He's a very sexist dude. No, there's a lot of discussion in the feminist literature about the whole idea of science as rape. I don't kid you not. And Bacon, if you look at the way Bacon talks about it, he sees nature as this woman who's not forthcoming with her secrets. Okay? And so you have to conduct experiments, and the experiments shows you the hidden side. And then you begin to see the potential that's there. This was Bacon's view, okay? So this is a very important part of how science works. Science, as it moves from field to field to field, operates precisely that way. Okay? You know, so you think about biology, all right? Even in Darwin's day, you know, in Darwin's day, so Darwin's writing about 150 years ago. In Darwin's day, you cut up an animal, you cut up a plant, and what you see is a lot of mess. Okay? You don't see any clear physical structures. You don't see the kind of thing a physicist is looking for. But very soon after that, you do start to get experiments done that actually are able to break down the organism into the tissues, into the cells, and eventually into the fundamental particles of life, the mitochondria, the DNA, and all the rest of it. Okay? And this happens, you know, from the third quarter of the 19th century, of course, into the middle of the 20th century with the discovery of the double helix model of DNA. Okay? Now, the interesting thing about this development is that it shifts biology almost entirely, not entirely, but very much, out of the field, because if you look at Darwin, where did Darwin do his empirical work? He watched the animals in their habitat. He studied the plants. Everything was happening outdoors. Okay? But what do you get? You get scientific laboratories. You start breeding things in greenhouses. Right? You start manipulating organisms to the extent you can to see how they come up with different varieties. And then you look into their internal workings to figure out their physical and chemical composition. And then you start thinking about how is it possible to get from a physical chemical state that is non-life to life? Okay? From inorganic to organic matter. Now, when you start thinking like that, you're in science land, right? Because differences that appear very big to the naked eye, like the difference between something that's living and not living, suddenly just becomes a matter of degree. The difference in chemical composition. And all you have to figure out is, what is that difference? And then, once you figure that out, you can start making some life of your own. Alright? And of course, once the genes are understood, you can start operating at a more fundamental level. And if you look at, think of something like stem cell research, what that's about, right? That's very much part of this trajectory, where you can kind of grow your own organs. Right? Potentially, we can have organ farms all over the place. Maybe one day it'll be just something that people will do as a hobby, like cultivating begonias, the flowers. Who knows? Right? It could become as simple as that. Okay? Now, the point here is what will have happened in the process is that things that were seen as qualitatively different and subject to different principles and, so for example, traditionally, and to this day, of course, the distinction between life and non-life has quite different cultural consequences in terms of how you treat things. If you find out something's living, you can't quite treat it the same way as when you regard it as non-living, right? So we do still have that distinction matter for purposes of social, political, and moral life. But of course, the scientific worldview may one day influence that too. Okay? But what the scientific worldview does is it does erase the qualitative nature of that distinction and makes it into a quantitative distinction. And again, it's the same idea. You bring in experiments, you bring in new ways of looking at things that radically change your paradigm shift. Your paradigm shift. Okay? So that's a very important part of what science is. That's the kind of thing that Conant wanted the students at Harvard to learn. They could learn about that by looking at the historical cases. They didn't have to learn the technicalities of the latest science to do that. Okay? Because all of those paradigm shifts occurred several decades, in some cases centuries ago. Okay? But that's Conant, right? Now Kuhn has other aspects. Kuhn has his other stuff. And in a way, the other stuff is the stuff that kind of distinguishes Kuhn from Popper. Because Popper can accept this idea of paradigm shift, okay? But there's other aspects of Kuhn's position that Popper cannot accept. But they are very much part of what Kuhn's up to. Kuhn believed that paradigms were collective things. By the standards of philosophers, he's got a very sociological conception of how science works. Okay? Now, what does that mean? Well, it's very interesting. First thing it means is that you have to be trained in the paradigm. Okay? So, in other words, when you become a scientist, you learn a paradigm. And that paradigm basically gives you the way in which you should look at the phenomena you're studying. So, nowadays, if you're a contemporary experimental biologist, you study what life is by, looking at a lot of cells, looking at a lot of DNA graphs, maybe looking at some genomes, who knows, doing some experiments. That becomes life for you. That is life. Life is seeing the world that way. And that's what you do your work on. Okay? Now, the problem arises when we think about what a paradigm shift looks like sociologically. So paradigms are these collective things that you are trained into when you're a scientist. Okay. Now suppose somebody proposes a radically new way of looking at the world. So we get, we'll think about Einstein. Okay, so Einstein is one of Kuhn's favorite examples. Right, Conant is trained as a chemist, Kuhn is trained as a physicist. Kuhn's big, heavy example that goes back to all the time is the shift from Newton to Einstein in the beginning of the 20th century. Right? That is to say, where you get rid of the idea of absolute space and time, okay, where the speed of light is a constant, right, which is being challenged now by those crazy neutrinos at CERN. But that's the Einstein revolution, right, because until Einstein, it was an open question whether light had a constant speed. Okay, and whether everything had to be traveling at that rate or lower. Okay. Okay? That was an open question for Newton. In a way, it's closed for Einstein. So light's the one constant. Okay. So Einstein introduces this view, by the way, basically by reinterpreting experiments, showing a lot of experiments that in a way were causing problems for Newton's view of physics. They all had to do with light, and he comes up with this alternative understanding of physics that suspends some of Newton's fundamental assumptions about absolute space and time. See, absolute space and time is basically the idea that there is, as it were, a fixed point in the universe in terms of which you can then measure everything. Whereas with Einstein, right, your measurement is relative to the speed at which you're traveling vis-a-vis some other object you're measuring. So it's relativized in a fundamental way. But Newton imagined it was like a God point, you might say, a fixed point where God hung out, which kind of everything had the same, was in the same time zone from a physics standpoint. Okay. And Einstein suspends this. Okay. Now, he comes up with some kind of mathematically interesting way of showing how this would explain a lot of stuff that Newton can't explain. And so now the question is, do you believe this? You're a physicist. You're a trained physicist. Here's this guy. He's 26 years old. He's not working as a professor of physics. He's working in a patent office. Okay? So this is the kind of guy we're talking about. He writes these papers. He sends them into the leading physics journal in Germany. The editor of the journal is Max Planck, one of the founders of quantum mechanics and winner of the Nobel Prize. Planck cleans up some of Einstein's mathematics, which is a little weird. He cleans it up, makes it acceptable, publishes the paper in his journal. Question becomes, what do you make of this? Is this something to cause you to change your fundamental view about the physical universe a la Newton? Does it cause you to do that? Or do you say, oh, that's a kind of interesting alternative. That's kind of mathematically interesting, but that doesn't correspond to reality. That's just, as it were, it's just a kind of another way of looking at things. This was the issue. Now Kuhn poses the problem. What is the way in which this kind of dispute how does it get resolved? Now you see, if you were somebody like Karl Popper, the way you would resolve a dispute like that would be by arguing with people, right? So people who defend Einstein would say, look, this is the reason why. Look at this proof. You guys can't explain that. We can. You should change your mind and believe what we believe. Right? It's a very kind of philosophical, rationalist way to go. And, you know, there's a certain kind of image of what a scientist is supposed to be, someone who's open to reasoning and evidence, and when the evidence changes, your mind changes, right? We hear this all the time. This is what science is about. This is why Popper believed science was an open society. Okay? It's a pretty clear view. This is Popper's view. Popper, in fact, says that scientists should welcome these opportunities to change their mind. You only get closer to the truth by relieving yourself of error. This is Popper. Falsifiability, you may have heard of this phrase. Falsifiability of hypotheses. That's what this is about. Right? You put yourself in a position where even your most fundamental assumptions can be shown to be wrong. So these people should welcome the fight. They should have the argument. Right? That's what it would look like in a perfect scientific world. Kuhn's point was, this world doesn't exist. Right? Kuhn's point is the world that Popper is describing. However nice it is, however much we may want it, however much scientists themselves say they believe in it, is not the real world of science. Okay? That's a very fundamental difference between Kuhn and Popper. Scientists do not behave like this. They are like every other interest group. They stick to their beliefs as long as they can, especially if they've been raised with them. And this is the idea of being trained in a paradigm. That original notion from Kuhn, right? It's a collective thing. My identity as a physicist is wrapped up in believing this Newton shit. I'm not just going to let this go quickly, because my identity is wrapped up with that. Right? Because the science, the views like Newton's, any important scientific theory isn't just a scientific theory. It isn't just a way of summarizing evidence. It is more, right? It is a kind of cultural badge in a way, right? It is a form of expertise, right? It's got all that stuff. Now you see, Popper and the logical positivists wanted scientists not to believe that, right? They wanted scientists to be in the vanguard of being critical, self-critical inquirers. But Kuhn's point is, scientists are just like everybody else. Scientists are, they've got their expertise, they've been raised in that, their identity is bound up with it, they are not going to let go of their fundamental beliefs easily. So then how does change happen? Well, the first point is, right, Kuhn's book is entitled Structure of Scientific Revolutions. There will be blood. Right? The change is not going to happen through people persuading each other in some nice, peaceful fashion. That's not how it's going to happen. Sorry, Popper, wrong. So how does it happen? We have a revolution, which means a massive shift from people believing one thing to people believing something else. So what's the secret? How does it happen? Generation shift. Okay? Generation shift. That is the explanation, that is a very important point. Because the old guys do not change their mind. Some of the old guys do. Max Planck, for example. So the really smart old guys, they see this coming and they are helpful. But if we're talking about this from a demographic standpoint, what do most of the old guys do? Including the mediocre old guys. Okay? They die with their boots on. They do not change. But of course they die, and that's the good news. Right? And indeed, death is perhaps the most powerful way of revolutionizing science. Old people die eventually. And this is why immortality could kill science. You need new people thinking about the problems. Okay? New people who are not invested in the old ways. Because see, the big problem with the old guys isn't that their brains are fossilized or something. That's not the problem. The problem is that they have been involved with this view for so long, they're all wrapped up in it. Right? And so it would be very difficult for them to change. Whereas the new people aren't really invested. So in a sense, what you want to look for, when you look at something like the revolution of Einstein, what you don't want to do is you don't want to just do a snapshot of what people thought in 1905. Because you know the answer. You know, aside from a few guys like Planck, most people are going to resist this. Most people are going to be against this. That's obvious. What you want to look at is what people believe 20 years later. Because the people who were the students at the time, who don't yet have the commitment to the old paradigm, but are studying to become part of the science, they're the ones who matter. And that's how you see the shift. The shift is kind of a silent shift, because the people whose minds matter don't have much of a voice at the time. So they're not writing articles and books and things like that. But they're there in the classroom, they're reading the stuff, they're listening to the arguments, and they're thinking about matters differently from the old guys. So this is the point. And so there have, in fact, been studies done that this also helps to account for the acceptance of Darwin among natural historians in the late 19th century. You could look at it really a generation shift. Okay, and in fact, this idea that the generation shift is what matters was an idea that Max Planck himself came up with and wrote about in his own autobiography. Because when he was reflecting in his career as a scientist, and he was thinking about how did this massive revolution take place in the early 20th century? Because Max Planck lived, I believe, in the 1940s. He said it was this. The old guys just dropped out of sight. And the new people took over. And they were very open-minded with regard to this. Okay? Now you see, this is an interesting kind of conclusion to reach. Okay, and see, part of what Kuhn is trying to get across, which really goes against what Popper's saying, is that at the end of the day, in order to do science, there is a sense in which your mind has to be kind of rigid, okay? Rigid in a particular way. Namely, you have to be committed to a theory and a body of method sufficiently to stick at it to, as it were, realize its full potential. You cannot be, you know, because as you know, in sociology and in the humanities, we just kind of change theories like changing underwear, right? We just move from one, it's all fads and fashions, right? This week it's one guy, the next week it's another guy, and of course we mix and match concepts all the time from different guys. So the idea of there being some kind of systematic, coherent way of approaching a set of problems over a long period of time to see what kind of results you get, that is unheard of in these fields that we're in. Right? The only people who ever stick with anything long enough to get serious results are the natural scientists. Okay? And the thing is, you really do have to kind of run a theory into the ground to see its limits. It's rarely, you know, so if you look at Newton, right? Newton, 1687, publishes Principia Mathematica. What a work, okay? Nobody can read it. It's just full of proofs and equations, and it claims to be giving you a systematic mathematical presentation of matter in motion in the heavens and the earth for the first time. And to a large extent, it lived up to the hype. It lived up to the hype for 200 years. Okay? That's a long time for anything subject to systematic testing to last. See, one of the things about our fields, of course, is the same theories can kind of cycle in and out over centuries because no one ever tests them very thoroughly. They just get accepted because people kind of like how they sound at a given moment in time, then they fall out of fashion, then they get picked up again. But with something like Newton's Principia Mathematica, people really went to town with this and applied it to everything. So the some phenomena, so Newton didn't explain light very well, and that ended up killing his theory in the end, but people immediately tried to apply the theory to light, right? And then other phenomena that Newton didn't really have a grip on, like electricity and magnetism in the 18th and 19th centuries, people applied Newton to that. They stuck with it. Okay, they stuck with it. Now, you see, for Kuhn, that kind of rigidity is necessary in order to get results, in order to show long-term progress. Okay? So it is not, from Kuhn's standpoint, there's nothing wrong with that fact, namely that the scientists stick to their theories till the end, and it takes a different generation to move the science forward. He said, that's fine. That is what makes it science. But you see, the kind of view that implies is one where scientists basically are operating with what in Kuhn's day, you know, Kuhn's book is written in 62, already in 1962, there is this jargon that is beginning to come out of social psychology. Groupthink. Okay, this is a Cold War thing, you know. The idea being that a bunch of people in a room, so imagine a bunch of advisors who are thinking about how to prosecute a war, right? And because it's a national security issue, very few people are allowed in the room, right? And these are the people who are cooking up the strategy. It's very easy for that group of people because they are all talking to each other all the time, they all have a vested interest on being in the same side, right, that they end up pursuing a certain line of battle, a certain strategy, into the ground as a disaster and don't recognize it. But they just keep on plowing ahead. You know, in the Vietnam War, it was a classic case of groupthink, right? Where, in a sense, if you weren't in the room and you were just looking at this from the outside, you'd say, there's going to be trouble, guys, you should stop. But no, but you're not in the room. You're not part of the groupthink. And the people who are in the room think, just send another 25,000 troops. That's our little take. And that'll do it. Okay? Groupthink. Well, in a sense, a paradigm is groupthink. Only groupthink happening over several generations. Right? So everybody thinks the same way, reinforces the thinking, and then they get as much as they can out of it, and until it collapses. And it collapses out. right? Kuhn talks about the word anomaly, right? An anomaly is a problem that doesn't go away, that doesn't get solved, that keeps on popping up and you can't resolve by your paradigm.
Okay, so this is a... Let's see, where are we on the time front here? Yes, okay.
Okay, let me just take a little break for questions. Questions, any issues people want to raise at this point?
Project. So it's not an accumulation of different times, I guess.
Well, I'm going to get to that, because in a sense the textbook issue addresses that point. Okay, let me say a little bit more about the textbook. Yeah.
And how is there any difference between brainstorming and group thinking here?
Between what and
group brainstorming and
brainstorming. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Is there any difference between them here and paradigm can be resolved from brainstorming too?
No, but see, I think that the key thing about groupthink is the people sticking with the same viewpoint. Mm-hmm. Whereas brainstorming is basically trying to get people to open up to new ideas. The point about groupthink is when people are used to talking to each other and have a certain way of thinking about something already, like how a war is proceeding, then it becomes very difficult to introduce new ideas because, in a sense, they seem to be ruled out by definition. People can't imagine certain possibilities after a while, right? Because if they were to imagine those possibilities, that would undermine all the things they already believe. Okay, so that's a groupthink puts a kind of a limit around the way you think. But the point is, the people who have this groupthink could be working in different fields, but they nevertheless share a kind of common way of seeing the world. Okay? So it's quite a subtle thing, right? Now, the textbooks are important because the textbooks basically tell the student how all the different parts of the science fit together to contribute to this paradigm. Okay? So the way the history gets told, so physics, right? You're studying physics now. But, of course, what your textbook will tell you is that physics has been around forever. Okay? That physics has this very long and distinguished history. So you might even start by talking about the Greeks. You know? Thales thought everything was water. First moment in physics. Okay? He was wrong, but, you know, he was trying. And so the point is, then, the history of physics is basically about talking about these very important events where discoveries get made of various kinds, and showing how they relate to each other so that the main theories and methods that people are using now look like a logical outcome of that. Okay? So, let's see if this is a little darker. There's this phrase, Whig history. Have any of you run across this before? Because this is very important to you. This is the kind of history that the textbook tells. Okay? Whig history is the short version, then I'll give you the longer version. The short version is Whig history is history told from the standpoint of the winners, which is to say the dominant paradigm, right? The people who are dominating the field at the moment. How do you make the past look like it's always been leading up to you? That you are the natural successors of all of the great achievements of the past in your field. And that is how the textbooks are written.
Well, actually, I think that's the way we think about our life.
Personally,
you think about you make sense of your history in relation to your success at the moment.
Well, some people do that. They have a positive turn of mind, right? Some people think they're losers, right? But you're right. If you have a positive frame of mind, yes, that's exactly
right. You've got to think of Whig history.
Yeah.
You've got to fit in everything how this success happened.
See, this is the thing. I mean, the phrase comes from the English Civil War, where the Whig Party being the anti-royal party, right? The party of Parliament wins the Civil War, and Parliament comes to dominate the political scene, and the king gradually recedes in political importance, right? So the people who are writing history after the Civil War, right, basically portray the history as the story of liberty, right? What is this history about? It's about liberty, and that's what we champion as Whigs. Now, to go to your point, then, of course, one of the things you do need to talk about is the fact that the history isn't smooth, right? There are setbacks, right? There are problems along the way. But of course, those things get portrayed as challenges. Challenges that make you stronger when you overcome them. Okay? And so, in the history of physics, one talks about the great experiments, you know, from which you discover new things, which challenge your taken for granted ideas. But that story is contained within an overarching story where you're headed to where you are now. So even though there were some setbacks, some people made some mistakes, some errors were made, it all gets fine in the end. Okay? Now Kuhn says this is a very important way of doing the history of science. Kind of in terms of the lines you were talking about, because scientists need to motivate themselves. Right? Because you think about it. Think about what a scientist is like. Okay? I'm not talking about Newton or Einstein, those important guys. I'm talking about your everyday scientist. Okay? And Kuhn is very explicit about this in his book. He says, and this is maybe one reason why Kuhn didn't want to stay a scientist. It's boring. Right? You're working on very small technical problems. Okay? There's a very good chance that even if your work is recognized now in your lifetime, it will be surpassed by somebody else in the future, and you will be forgotten. And you will have spent all of this time staring at some meter in a lab or something like that. That is what most scientists do, right? That's most of their lives. So it becomes very important then to provide a motivating narrative. Right? Some kind of overarching story that shows that in your own little way, you are contributing to the march of progress. Okay? So Kuhn thinks this is really important to get the, because you've got to, you know, every generation you have to enroll new recruits into the paradigm. And of course, what are they going to be doing once they're in the paradigm? They're going to be doing all of this minute, technical, and consequential work. So how do you sell them on this idea? Not by describing what they're actually going to have to do, but by giving them this kind of myth, right? Giving them this kind of story about what the science is. And on top of that, let me add, this story has amazing export value. Because if you look at the popular accounts of the history of science, right? The kinds of things that, you know, if ordinary people know anything about the history of science, they know some watered-down version of this. Okay? And this is where people believe that science makes progress. That knowledge advances. We're getting closer to the truth. Thing, you know, we're building on the past. All of this kind of very taken-for-granted ways. Even if people know nothing about science at all, they nevertheless have this kind of general view about science. Okay? And this is something that is basically a watered-down version of the Whig history that the students are taught. Now, the interesting thing about the times in which we live in now, right? So, we, you know, we're living 50 years after Kuhn wrote his book, is, of course, probably fewer people believe that science makes progress than in a very, certainly than when I was a kid, it was taken for granted that science made progress. How many of you believe that science makes progress? You think a few fields do and a few don't?
Yeah.
What kind of field do you think makes progress? Give me an example of a field that makes progress.
Well,
yeah, come on, you said you, but whatever you, how, you know, in one of the ways I've just been talking about, right, that you're getting closer to the truth, you're building on the past, knowledge is accumulating, I mean, these are the kinds of ideas that we're talking about that you get in the Whig history.
I think that from a pragmatist, from a pragmatic perspective, you can say it does make progress, but as getting closer to the truth, that's a whole different ballgame.
So when you say pragmatic, you mean what? It allows us more control over the world. What do you mean by pragmatic?
Not control over the world, but some kinds of results in that are congruent, but we define as that they work.
So we get results we like. This is progress.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is a kind of very minor notion. Progress usually implies a kind of historical trajectory where you imagine that there have been lots of people, as it were, trying to do what we now do so much better. Right? That's progress. Progress is not just something, as it were, we justify to ourselves, but we somehow imagine that our predecessors were aiming for the same things. You don't believe that?
No.
That's interesting, because the
other
thing I was a kid. Yeah, that kind of progress I've just described. and you show him the state of biology, which was a subject he had a lot of time for, okay? And what we understand about the nature of life and animals and all the rest of it, wouldn't he be impressed? Or would he just say, you guys are crazy?
Probably say, very interesting.
But would you think, would he be impressed in the sense that he said, ah, I can see you are able to solve problems that I pose much better than I could?
Probably.
You think he'd say that? Okay. That's progress. That would be an example for, but you don't believe that.
Not exactly. I mean, progress in the sense that we understand more of the nature of what's going on.
Sure.
But not progress in the benefit to society. Like, it would maybe question.
No, no, but we don't know if I mean, I don't believe that we don't understand. We understand. I mean, if we are understanding how things are going on, we've got nothing to prove that we are. I don't know. If
well, let me give you. Here's an issue that Aristotle would raise with us. You tell me what you think about this, okay? Aristotle believed, as in fact was very common to believe until the time of Galileo and Newton. Like that there were only certain things that could be quantified. Okay? In other words, there are certain things that you cannot measure or count in any kind of meaningful way for purposes of understanding. I mean, you can count them in the sense of, you know, in a simple sense, but it didn't have any kind of scientific value. Life would be an example for him. Okay, so living things have to be understood qualitatively. So even though we can talk about whether things are as we're developing or degenerating, what we cannot do is measure. We can make qualitative judgments. We can make judgments about whether things are living and dying. We can make all those judgments, but we cannot measure them. Okay? Now, of course, we will now show Aristotle all of the statistics that we can gather, vital statistics, we can measure all kinds of things about that indicate to us things are living or not living and so forth. Okay? Aristotle, he would say, wow, you can't do that. That goes against the nature of life. Okay? What would you do with him at that point? Would you say, Aristotle, you're just wrong?
No.
Why not say, Aristotle, you're just wrong?
Because there's no certainty. I mean, the problem here, the whole definition of progress, as you're defining it right now, needs certainty to be established. And I don't.
It's not that it needs certainty. What it needs is a certain kind of you might say a fixed point, right? You need some common standard by which you can compare what people at different times believe, okay? And this goes to this point that Kuhn makes a big deal about. Incommensurability. Incommensurability means when things are not comparable, when you cannot compare things. And what Kuhn argues is that when you go through a paradigm shift, right, the paradigm that you move from and the paradigm you move to are incommensurable. Now, how do you know this? Well, because the kind of Whig history that you tell in the two paradigms is radically different. Because when you have the paradigm shift, your science is going in a different direction. And so what you then do is you take exactly the same history as the last paradigm took, and you reinterpret it. So now it leads up to you instead of leading up to them. Okay? And it's really very interesting. When the revolution in physics took place with Einstein, as late as about 1930, I think, there was this textbook used. First of all, the title of the textbook was "Theories of Ether and Electricity." Now, ether is an entity, a physical entity from the Newtonian worldview, which is basically the medium through which physical forces, including light, operate. Okay? Einstein disposes of this concept with his revolution. But you still have a textbook published as late as the 1930s, Theories of Ether and Electricity. And then you look at the way in which the textbook is organized in terms of, it's presented historically. And Einstein is just presented as a little footnote to the dominant view, which is an ether-based view of electricity. Okay? Then you get the Einstein version of that same subject being covered, and everything is organized quite differently. Who got the stuff right? Who got the stuff wrong? What was the significance of all the experiments done? The same events are talked about, but they're all spun systematically differently. Okay? It's like a parallel universe, almost. Where certain guys who were thought to be wrong turn out to be right, where experiments that were thought to be decisive turn out to be marginal. It's the same events, but spun systematically differently, because you've got a different outcome you're aiming for. That's an example of incommensurability. Okay? And Kuhn says this is just inevitable. Right? So the point here being that if Aristotle were to come here, and we told Aristotle, you know, all of the wonderful things we've done in biology, and we'd say, look, you know, we're able to solve problems you couldn't solve, Aristotle's response, according to Kuhn, would be, I wasn't trying to solve those problems. I was trying to solve my own problems, and I did perfectly fine doing it my own way. And you guys, I don't know what the hell you guys are doing, but God bless you. You know, just keep on going. But I am not part of your history. Okay? That's the interesting thing. Now, of course, we are not blessed with Aristotle's company, and that helps us out a lot. Right? So we've got all of these dead guys whose views we can interpret however we feel like in order to support the view of history we want to promote. That's a very important point, okay? Because if all of those guys from the past were to look at how we use their work and how we use it to justify what we're doing, they would probably all disagree with us. They would want nothing to do with us. This is what Kuhn said. Whereas somebody like Popper, and I think the logical positivist, would say that at a very deep level, there is continuity. That Aristotle, when Aristotle was looking for the nature of life, okay, he was trying to figure out what we're trying to figure out when we're looking for the nature of life. Now you see, where do your intuitions stand on that? Do you think that that's the... Do you think... Because we, modern biological science, claim to have a very ancient...